thank you. I was amused by the mention of F.E. Smith, because I know him only through a G.K. Chesterton poem that a few of you may be familiar with, and he is not the hero of that poem. I should mention, by the way, that among the things I've written are a couple of novels. One of them is up as a Kindle. It's called Salamander. And it actually has something to do with libertarian ideas, although that's not really its subject. The reason I'm mentioning it is that on Amazon US it's got 11 reviews, and on Amazon UK it has 0 reviews. So if any of you happen to read it, it's called Salamander, but that would be another story. Let me start by saying that I think there is a sense in which everybody is a conservative, not a political sense. That is, everybody tends to take for granted the arrangements he's familiar with, and to suppose that if things are done in a certain way, that's the only way they can be done. Really the point of my talk this evening is to argue against one part of that, that we observe that certain things in the societies we're familiar with are done by government, and we assume they can only be done by government. And I think one can argue both on the evidence of various past historical societies and of economic theory that all of the things in question could be done in other ways, that it might be better if they were done in other ways. I'm not willing to say that I can prove it would be. And I'm going to look at three parts of the question, three features of human society that we associate with government. One of them is private property. One of them is contracts. And one of them is law in general, criminal tort law, all the rest of it. And let me start out with property, because there is a very common claim which is made by lots of people that is demonstrably false. And that's the claim that property is entirely creation of government law. Without government, you could not have property, and this is then offered as a plausible-seeming argument for saying, why do you object to the state taking some of your stuff? It's only your stuff because they guarantee it to you. And the proof that this statement is false is that the institution of property not only predates government, it predates the human species. That a primitive form of property is observed in many animal species. It's called territorial behavior. And I believe that understanding territorial behavior helps us understand the much fancier version of the same pattern among humans. The way territorial behavior works, usually for birds and fishes, although there are some mammals that are territorial as well, is that a member of the species somehow marks out its claim to a certain area of territory. And having done that, will fight more and more desperately against a trespasser of its own species and gender that crosses into that territory. And the essential fact here is that unless two members of a species are very unequal in size and strength, a fight to the death is a loss for both, because the winner is likely to get injured by more than is ever worth fighting for. And given that, if I know that the claimant has somehow committed himself to fight as hard as he has to defend his territory, it doesn't pay me to trespass. And the result is that for territorial species, not that trespass never happens, but that as a general rule, the claimant manages to defend his territory and trespassers retreat when they're challenged. That, it seems to me, is property. Now, it's a very primitive form of property. They can't transfer it. They don't have, you know, leases. They don't have all sorts of things we have, but it nonetheless is recognizably property. And it's property which is enforced by commitment strategies. It's enforced by the fact that somehow, and presumably there's a switch inside the brain that we don't understand, but somehow this bird or this fish has changed himself such that he will feel terribly aggrieved at the trespasser and will fight even to the death to stop the trespasser. And my claim is that if you think about how modern societies, as well as other societies, really work, a mechanism along these lines still exists. And my sort of standard example is to imagine I'm living in a suburban neighborhood which doesn't have very well-organized law enforcement or political institutions. And one day my neighbor talks to me over the fence and he says, you know, I've been thinking about it. Carrying my trash to the dump is a real pain. So I've decided that from now on I'm just going to dump my trash over the fence onto your property. And you know, and I know, that getting the town government to do anything about it is going to be a real pain, because you'll have to prove it's my trash, and they'll come Wednesday maybe if you're in, and so forth and so on. It's just not worth the trouble for you to do it. But I got a deal for you. Pay me $10 a month and I won't. And the question is, why do I turn down that deal? I predictably will turn down that deal. Almost anybody in our society will. And the answer is the same as the reason the bird or the fish fights. That I have marked out in my mind a non-geographical boundary of what I see as my rights, and have somehow turned a switch in my brain so that I'm willing to bear not infinite costs, but large costs, larger costs than the amount of stake seems to be worth in order to defend that boundary. And I think if you try to make sense of how real human societies work, that that's a central part of it. This is the way I put it in one article of mine, which you can read because it's on my webpage, like lots of other things, is that part of the puzzle is how we ever get out of a Hobbesian state of nature. That Hobbes says that man in his natural state, everybody's everybody else's enemy, sneak up and kill people and so forth. Why isn't that the world we know? That it doesn't do any good to say because there are police enforcing the law. Why are they enforcing the law? Why aren't they sneaking up and killing people? There are judges, yeah, but putting a wig on somebody doesn't make him behave any differently, or putting a fancy suit on him or calling him Your Honor. Why do people behave in such a patterned and organized and generally peaceful way? And I think a good deal of the answer is a complicated network of commitment strategies in which fighting might be physical, it might be willing to sue people, you can imagine all different ways you can fight. But commitment strategies such that they are mutually recognized, such that I know that there are certain things if I try to do to you, you will impose large costs on me, as best you can. And you know, you and I know consistently, and when they aren't consistent, you get into conflicts and problems. One of the reasons why cultural boundaries tend to have frictions. So I think that makes a good deal of sense. And that exists with or without the state. Somebody a while ago gave me an interesting example having to do with parking places in Chicago. In Chicago, as you may know, it sometimes snows a lot. And when it snows a lot, it's necessary to shovel out parking places. And when somebody has shoveled out a parking place and then drives off with his car, he doesn't want to come back in 15 minutes and find someone else parked there. So he marks it in some way, the equivalent of the ways in which animals mark their territory. He puts a chair in it or something. If he comes back and finds another car there, it's quite likely that when the owner of the car comes back, his paint has been scratched or his windshield broken or something unpleasant has happened to it. All right, that's a commitment strategy. It doesn't pay me to damage your car, because after all, I might get caught, but you have stolen my parking place, and I got to defend it. So that's sort of an interesting modern example of the same pattern happening in a modern society. So that sort of is my first example of a way in which something we think of as depending on the government is in fact done by private mechanisms, via commitment strategies. And if you're curious, the article on my webpage is called A Positive Account of Property Rights. And it's not really about property rights because it applies to rights in general, but it was for a conference on property rights. And by a positive account, I mean that I'm thinking of rights not as either a moral or a legal category, but as a behavioral category. The fact that I have a right to something, at one sense, means it will rarely pay you to violate it. And one reason might be the government will put you in jail, but another reason might be that I will get very angry at you and do things you don't like scratching your paint. All right, so that was the first point. Second is contract. And the question is, how would you maintain, in order to have a functioning economy of any degree of complication, people need ways of making and enforcing contracts with each other. And how would you do it without government to enforce contracts? And that's a question which ought to be of interest even in the societies that now exist, at least to lawyers and their customers. Because part of the job of the customer is to keep his customer from having to go to court, because going to court is expensive and risky. And therefore, if you think about the question, if there were no government enforcing contracts, how would we get people to keep contracts? That would be a useful answer to how do we get people to keep contracts without having to call in the government. And in thinking about this, I have two examples in mind, one of which is a real historical example, and one of which is my thoughts on a developing real world example. And the first one is Imperial China. About 1900, China ceded the island of Formosa to Japan, and the Japanese, probably sensibly, decided that instead of trying to impose Japanese law on a Chinese population, they would just enforce existing Chinese law. And to do that, they had to find out what it was. And so there was an extensive scholarly project to research what Chinese law on Taiwan was about 1900. The output of that project survives. I've read a summary of parts of it. And one of the most interesting features is that Chinese law had essentially no contract law. Indeed, Chinese law, as far as I can tell, had nothing we would think of as civil law. That if I lend money to you and you don't pay it back, there is no way to sue you. All I can do is to go to the district magistrate and report you as a swindler. It's a criminal, not a civil offense. The district magistrate could say to you, pay him the money or else I will try you as a swindler. He could say, pay him half the money and I'll forget about it. He could say, I'm not interested in that case. That's up to him. Just as an ordinary criminal case, if you report somebody for breaking a law, it's up to the DA to decide whether to prosecute. The difference between criminal and civil. So they had a few contract laws, but they in fact weren't enforced. They had a maximum interest law, and interest was normally higher than that. Nonetheless, it turns out they had very elaborate contractual practice. That if you look at what the Chinese merchants were actually doing, they were doing long-distance trade across the Formosa Straits to the mainland with importing things and exporting things and making contracts with each other. And somehow that was working, despite the fact that the most you could do is to accuse somebody who cheated you of a crime. And so I have a discussion. I have an article which, for reasons I'll explain in a minute, is called From Imperial China to Cyberspace, discussing the ways in which they did it. And the reason for that title is that if you think about the situation for doing business online, it looks very similar. That it's not impossible to use ordinary courts, but when you're in a world where national boundaries are invisible, where you can be dealing with somebody in China one day, in India 15 minutes later, in Chile 15 minutes after that, you may not even know where they are. Given the technology, it's even possible to deal with anonymous people in various ways. It is relatively hard to do enforcement via the court system. And that means that you need to develop ways in which you can contract with people online and enforce those contracts without having to rely on the courts. So in that sense, it seems to me the same issues are of interest to the merchants in China 100 and some years ago as to the people developing business online. And I've talked actually to one person who's in the business, essentially, of contract enforcement online, and it was quite interesting, sort of comparing the real-world issues as he saw it with my thoughts and theory. So how do you do it? And there are first two basic mechanisms, and then a whole lot of tricks. And one of the basic mechanisms is what we refer to as the discipline of constant dealings. That if you're a repeat player with somebody, you know that if you cheat him today, he won't do business with you tomorrow. So in that sense, in a certain narrow subset of contract, you don't really need contract law. You need some rules so you know what defines cheating, but you don't need anybody enforcing the rules, because if you cheat a guy, he'll know, and that will be costly. But that's not going to work all the time. And the other method that works is reputational enforcement. My guess is that in modern societies, quite a lot of contract enforcement is not through the state. That if I imagine that I buy a jacket, sports jacket, from a store that says money back, no question, if you're not satisfied. And when I bring the jacket home, my wife points out that purple is not my color, and 46 large is not my size, and I go take it back to the store. If they refuse to accept it, I doubt I would sue them. The sums involved are not larger than they were, and yet they will accept it. Why do they accept it? Because they don't want me to not only is it repeat dealings, they want me to keep dealing with them. They don't want me to tell all my friends what sleaze they are for not keeping their contracts. Now, if you think about the logic of that, why does that work? Why do my friends, or even my enemies, that's the interesting part, choose not to do business with that store after I tell them that they refuse to take back the jacket? It's not because they want to punish the store. Because it'll be true of my enemies too. It's because they don't want to get cheated themselves. All right? So what's happening in reputational enforcement is that the enforcement is an indirect result of the fact that information that you have behaved badly goes to third parties who alter their behavior in ways that make you worse off. Now, there's a critical problem with informational enforcement. Suppose when I complain about the store, the person who hears me doesn't know whether I'm telling the truth. Suppose he thinks maybe what happened was that he burnt the sleeve and then wanted to take it back. No wonder they wouldn't take it back. If I can't easily show third parties that I'm telling the truth, not only does it not work, I will never report it. Because suppose, let's leave the jacket out. I have a contract with you. We have a dispute. I claim you broke the contract. You claim I broke the contract. I go to other people and complain about it. The other people, if they don't know who's telling the truth, will rationally say, 50-50, one of those two guys is dishonest, let's not deal with either of them. That being the case, I never report it, because it'll hurt me to report it. So that means that the critical factor for making a critical factor for reputational enforcement working is somehow arranging things so that costs for third party are low, of finding out who's wrong. And in my view, one of the major functions of private arbitration is to lower costs to third parties. That if you know, if the third party knows that the two of us agreed in advance that the American Arbitration Association would settle our disputes, and if the American Arbitration Association reports that they ruled in my favor and he refused to pay off, now it's easy for the third party to tell which of us is the bad guy. So I think if you look at ways in which reputational enforcement works, one critical element is ways of lowering those costs. Arbitration is one example. Very simple rules so that you can easily know who broke them is another example. In the case online, I don't know how many of you know much about digital signatures, but a digital signature, there's a technology called public key encryption, which would take me too long to explain. You can find stuff about that on my website, too. But the bottom line of that is that you and I can write a contract and sign it in such a way that a third party can, at trivial cost, prove that both of us signed it. This is what digital signatures do. Furthermore, that contract could specify the arbitrator to enforce the contract, include the information that will let you identify his signature, which is what's called his private key. So you and I sign a contract. We specify him as the arbitrator. You break the contract, in my view. I take it to arbitration. He rules in my favor. You refuse to pay off. He then gives me a written statement that that happened, which he has signed, and I put it up on the web with your name all over it, so that anybody who wants information on you will find that web page, and at the cost of a second and a half of computer time, he can answer the question who cheated, because he can not for certainty, the arbitrator might have made a mistake, but he can answer the question, is it true that the arbitrator that they both agreed to ruled in one person's favor and that the other person didn't do it? That's a really low information cost mechanism. So other ways of doing it, if you look at the Chinese case, one of them is you try to structure your contract in such a way that at any point when a party pulls out, that party will be worse off. So if you're paying somebody to build a house, you don't pay him in advance. You pay him all the money in advance. If he can get away with it, he takes the money and leaves. You pay him a little bit as it goes on. And nor do you pay him all the money at the end. Because you've paid him all the money at the end. At the end, you might cheat him. You might say, well, look, I got the house. It's on my property. You want to take your boards away? Feel free, but it won't get you your money back. Let's renegotiate our price. All right. So that's why you've got to structure it. And if you think about it, you can imagine if you have a contract where different people are performing at different times, how you would structure the payments. In some cases, one side gives a deposit. In some cases, you have... But the basic idea is that you're imagining over time, as it were, how the returns to each party of breaking the contract will go, assuming that you leave things as they are at that point, because there's no law to enforce the agreements, and you then try to structure it so that neither party pays to break the contract. Now, there are cases where you can't do that, because you have uncertain events that you didn't know when you signed the contract, which might raise costs or benefits to either party. One of the problems is that if I give you a deposit, that lowers my incentive to break the contract but raises yours. All right? So one possibility is instead of a deposit, I give you a hostage. I do something such that you can hurt me, but that it won't profit you. And one of the hostages, I think, in the Chinese system was the ability to accuse me of being a swindler. That didn't help you, but it hurt me, and you would do that if I, in fact, swindled you. But there are lots of other examples. If we had more time, my very favorite hostage story has to do with an Englishman called William Marshall, who not as many Englishmen have heard of as should. He was a man who started out the fourth son of a minor baron during the Stephen and Matilda Civil War, and before he died, he was regent of England. And when he was a boy, he was a hostage and would have been killed if Stephen had been a harder-hearted man than he was. That's an interesting story if you want to talk about it afterwards, but I have a limited amount of time at the moment. But it's a favorite story of mine. But in any case, that's part of what you do. Suppose you can't do it. Suppose you can't figure out any way of arranging it so neither party ever has, ever, so you're sure neither party will ever have an incentive to breach the contract. In that case, I can make sure that I don't have a breach contract. All I gotta do is give a big enough deposit. All right? So what we do is you say, which of the parties is most constrained by reputation? Put the burden on him. And I think, if you actually look at the real world, quite a lot of what happens does fit that pattern, that the repeat player is the one who you set it up so you have to trust in order to do it. So in any case, the basics of what I'm saying so far is a sketch of how, without government enforcement, people can nonetheless do business with each other. Let me go on to law in general. And it is already the case, even in our society as well as in a variety of other societies, that a good deal of what's really law is happening outside of the state. For one thing, every contract involves the two parties writing their own legal system, because they're making rules for how they will behave and then some way of enforcing it. Furthermore, a organization like the American Arbitration Association is creating law, because they have rules saying how they will decide what rules of evidence they will have and so forth. And in fact, in the U.S., quite a lot of the government-enforced law is privately created, because we have a private body with no legal authority which publishes their opinion of what the common law is, and state legislatures frequently adopt that opinion. Again, go into that in more detail, but not at the moment. But there is another sense in which we have a great deal of private law. And that's because we have systems of norms. There's a very interesting book by Robert Ellickson, a Yale law professor, called Order Without Law. And he is describing a private legal system a couple of hours from where I live, in Shasta County, a rural county in California, where for certain issues, the law of the state of California does not run. Why does it not run? Because it's a fairly stable community, and there are a set of norms of neighborly behavior. And one of the strong norms of neighborly behavior is neighbors don't sue neighbors. So therefore, if you rely on the fact that you're right in the law of California but not in the norms of Shasta County and you sue me, you will lose more from your reputational costs with everybody else in the society than you'll gain by winning the suit. And Ellickson looked at a number of cases, not everything, but there are certain issues that arise in that society which are in fact determined by the norms of Shasta County, enforced in some cases by illegal acts with certain constraints, but acts that you can in fact get away with. So commitment strategies, if you like. But having said that much, I could also talk about other societies. My current project is a book on legal systems very different from ours, and that includes people like the Amish, who are in fact anarchists of a very odd and rule-bound kind of anarchists. It includes Saga period Iceland, which was a society with a legislature, a court system, and entirely private enforcement. There was no executive arm of government there to enforce the decisions of the courts. Traditional Somali law, which is sort of like Saga period Iceland, only different in interesting ways and so forth. But let me instead discuss what was the subject of part of my first book, which is a very brief sketch of what a modern society like ours might look like if you had private property and trade and didn't have government. And the basic sketch goes as follows. There are private firms which sell their customers the service of rights enforcement, also of settling disputes with other people. The obvious problem those firms face is what happens if there's a conflict between a customer of my firm and a customer of your firm. And each one claims he's in the right. Each firm is supposed to be committed. I claim you stole my television set. My firm wants the television set back. You, however, deny stealing the television set. My firm says we'll use force to take the television set. You say, well, I got a rights enforcement agency too, and they'll send people to defend me. Breaks down, violence, terrible result. This is what everybody who hears about this idea says in about the first 30 seconds. But it's the wrong answer, because fighting each other is very expensive, and these are profit-making firms. And it makes much more sense for when this problem arises for the two firms to get together and say, look, if we fight each other, who knows what will happen? We'll have to start paying hazard pay. The right guy may not win. How about we go to arbitration? And once such a system is established, people will realize this is a repeat game, that any two agencies which are operating in the same area are going to have conflicts from time to time. And so they will pre-contract to specify the private court that will settle their disputes. Now you may say, in this world there's no government, so what are contracts worth? Ah, But we've got the discipline of constant dealing, because these firms are repeat players for a long period of time. And my firm knows that if the first time that the court rules against their customer, they say, ha ha, we've decided to back out of this, next time they're going to have to fight because they've got no way of settling the dispute, because nobody else is willing to play a game of heads I win, tails you lose. So that's a self-enforced system. And we now have a society in which legal rules are being produced on the free market, in which systems of legal rules are themselves a private product. Because what's happening is that the individual arbitration agency is producing a product, which they are selling to the enforcement agencies. The individual court has, in effect, a legal code. And the agencies are saying, what legal code do our customers want to be under? So you could imagine that, suppose the customers of one agency are in favor of the death penalty and the customers of the other agency are against it. For whatever, you can think of lots of reasons, moral, practical, prudential, whatever. What happens is that each agency does a little market research. And the pro-death penalty agency just concludes that if they could guarantee their customers that in conflicts with that other agency, not everybody, but just that agency, that the death penalty would apply, that their customers would be willing to pay them an extra $100,000 a year for the service they provide with that extra quality. The other firm does similar research and concludes that they can get an extra $200,000 a year if they can guarantee not to have a death penalty. And the two firms agree on no death penalty and $150,000 side payment. Or no death penalty, and on some other issue, they go the other way. All right. Now, I've given a number of talks, which you can find on my webpage, discussing some problems that arise with this issue. The late Jim Buchanan wrote the one good review of my first book, where a good review is defined as one that makes the author think. And so I'm working currently on a third edition, dealing with some problems that he raised. And if you raise the same problems, I'll point you at the recordings of the talks, where one of them given in Buchanan House at George Mason, which was nice, the talks in which I try to give at least my answers. But what I've basically described is a system which, like ordinary market systems, tends to produce an efficient outcome. That just as it tends to be the case that if a car is worth building, if the value to the customers of a car is more than the cost of producing it, the car will get built on a market. Similarly, in my system, if a change in the law is worth having, if the change is worth more to those who gain by it than those who lose by it, that change will tend to happen as a result of the negotiations among these agencies. And I conclude, therefore, that my system solves the problem that, as far as I know, no political system has yet solved, which is how do you get the lawmakers to have a private incentive to make the right laws, which is what you would like them to do, what people assume they would do, that would, in fact, mostly they don't do and have no incentive to do under our ordinary systems. Let me try contrasting that to the current system, to political mechanisms for making laws. And one, there's what I like to refer to as the civics class model of democracy, the simple-minded explanation of why democracy works. And that is, the politicians have to do the right things, so if they do the wrong things, they'll be voted out. And the problem is that for some reason, politicians who do the wrong things never say so. That nobody runs on the platform of I'm a bad guy. And politicians who support laws that help some people and hurt other people are extraordinarily quiet about who they hurt. So that, for example, I do not believe that anyone has introduced into the U.S. Congress a bill that says a bill to make farmers richer and city folks poorer. And yet every year, bills representing many billions of dollars designed to raise the price of agricultural products, thus to make farmers richer and city folks poorer, are introduced into Congress. So what that means is that in order for the civics class model of democracy to work, the voter has to put a lot of time and effort into monitoring what his congressman is doing and what he should be doing. Not a trivial problem. Why should he do it? The rational voter says, well, population of 300 million people in the U.S., electorate of whatever, 200 million or so, maybe 100 million actually voting, chances that my vote will decide the outcome, they might be as high as 1 in 5 million. Therefore, it is not worth my spending large costs to change by 1 in 5 million the odds of the right guy winning the election. Yeah. More than 1 in 5 million for a congressman, but one congressman won't determine the loss. So I was thinking of the presidential case. And they're still low for the congressman. And this fits actual behavior. From time to time when I'm teaching a course, I ask my students how many of them know the name of their congressman. And generally about half of them do. Really hard to keep a track of what someone's doing if you don't know his name. So they're rational people. The other half, I assume, regard politics as an interesting hobby or spectator sport or something. So the argument is first that under the standard system, you have no incentive to monitor the people who are supposed to be making good laws. And if one carries it further, and I don't think I have time enough to do it at the moment, one works out that there are sort of inherent logic to the system such that it pays politicians to make laws that transfer wealth from dispersed interest groups to concentrated interest groups. Because if you have a realistic picture of the political system, which is really much more like a marketplace where people are buying legislation by support and campaign contributions and things like that, you realize that a concentrated interest group can solve its internal public good problem, the problem of how you raise money when, if we get an auto tariff, all the companies will benefit. How do we get all the auto companies to chip in to buy the tariff, to bribe the Congress to pass it? It's easier for the auto industry to solve that problem than for consumers of autos to solve that problem. Because the auto industry is a small number of firms. They can say, look, I'll put in money if you put in money, and if you refuse, it's just going to break down. Whereas the people injured by the tariff are a couple of 100 million people, and there's no way that they are going to coordinate in a way that will solve the problem of how to pay the money in order to stop the tariff. So there are lots of reasons why we would expect the political market, unlike the market I've described for law, to produce the wrong laws. Furthermore, it's also, if you compare that to the case of my system. In my system, if you research which rights enforcement agency does a better job, you have 100% chance of deciding the outcome for yourself, because you can change the guy you hire, just as in any ordinary market. So the incentive to be well-informed is a great deal higher in the private law system than in the public law system. Furthermore, the ability to be well-informed is higher. Nobody is ever going to be able to compare the results of the Obama administration of the last 4 years with the results of the McCain administration of the last 4 years, because only one of them got elected. All right. If you're buying cars, you've got the option of actually test driving both of the cars you're considering. We can't test drive both parties. That in practice, you would compare how one party did in one set of circumstances with how another party did in another set of circumstances, but people can always plausibly argue we faced problems they didn't face, we did pretty well given our problems, which is what Obama is going to claim, of course, perfectly reasonably. In my system, on the other hand, the different providers are all out there, and you can talk to your neighbor and say, when you got robbed, how fast did the private cops come? When you had a dispute with somebody, did they manage to settle it in a satisfactory way without absorbing too much time and energy and money? Things like that. Now, you can't do a perfect job, of course, or in ordinary markets, you can't do a perfect job. But my claim is that the system where law is produced on the private market, on a competitive market, is a better system for producing good law than the system where it's produced politically. Now, some of you may want to ask, I've been defining good law as an economist, as economically efficient law, meaning law where net benefits to people involved are maximized. Some of you may say, but we're liberals in the old sense of the word, or we're libertarians in the new sense of the word, we want to know whether the law will actually be free law. And my answer is probably, more likely than the other way. Because one of the things that make us liberals or libertarians is we believe liberty works. We believe that on the whole, with rare exceptions, it's worth more to me not to be coerced than it is to you to coerce me. And if that's right, then as a general rule, a law that will come out of a market producing economically efficient law will be law that is pretty heavily pro-freedom. Now, I could imagine exceptions. If you have a society where practically everybody believes that the use of heroin is a terrible thing, that might turn out that the market outcome will be laws against heroin, that I'll be able to sue you or get you locked up if you use heroin. But of course, in that society, you will certainly have laws against heroin if the government makes them. So my guess is that if you have a system where, in effect, to get a law against heroin, you've got to outbid the people who want to use heroin, that's a good deal less likely than you're outvoting them. So I think that in general, what I'm describing is likely to lead to a more libertarian society than alternatives, though not necessarily a perfectly libertarian society. I think that's really what I wanted to say, that you can ask a lot of questions about how it would work, and that would be another long discussion. You can read Machinery of Freedom. It's available for free download as a PDF from my website, or you can buy it if you like. And some of the problems I try to deal with and answer there, but not all of them. I'm working on a third edition in which I hope to deal with some more of the problems, and I've also got various articles scattered around. But I think I was asked to hold it down to half an hour. My usual experience is that the nice thing about answering questions is that when you're answering a question, you know at least one person in the audience is interested in what you're talking about. So I'll stop now.
Thank you very much. We do indeed have about 20 minutes for questions. I should explain that in this particular gathering, I am the monopoly enforcement agency. So it is only one question, please. I don't want people saying I'd like to ask three questions. One question and short questions only. And would you please give your name, please? Gentleman there.
Martin Anderson.
Thank you.
I was one of the technical optimists who, when the internet started up in the early, when trade in the internet started up in the early 90s, foresaw encrypted suppliers dealing with encrypted consumers, and basically the trade disappearing from the face of the fist, thereby creating pressure on, you know, the, as higher valued goods and services disappeared, bringing pressure down on less valued goods and services, and thereby increasing competition for a smaller state. But it didn't happen. Just because it was
I think part of it is because not enough people have an incentive to maintain privacy. That privacy is a neat idea, but if it's a good deal of nuisance, so most people don't bother to use encryption. On the other hand, private law enforcement has developed. If you look at how eBay does things, eBay in fact has engineered reputational enforcement mechanisms to try to make it possible to keep people honest and settle disputes outside of the court system. So some of the things we expected to happen and some of the things didn't. We expected didn't happen, and maybe some of them will happen in the future.
Let me get a mood for the meeting. Who feels a question sort of welling up inside them? Right, okay. Let's start there.
Hello, Tim Metcalf. I can understand how reputational enforcement would work with trading companies. I can see how neighbours would obviously want to make sure that they get on well together, because you don't want your neighbour coming around in the middle of the night. But when you've got a company like, for example, GSK, who deals with intellectual property, they come out with a wonder drug, a company in India, copy it a month later. You know, who ultimately then enforces that? GSK can't send boys around to India and smash the factory up, for example. So, where's the enforcement coming in that?
You're asking about intellectual property, I think. You're asking, I don't know what GSK means, but...
Oh, sorry,
you're asking about intellectual property. Yeah, the answer is that my system will under-enforce intellectual property. This is one of the points I've actually discussed in print, that the bargaining is between two enforcement agencies. And suppose we're bargaining over whether he will have to respect my copyrights. His respecting my copyrights results in a transfer because he pays me royalties. It results in some cost because I've got to enforce it. I've got to make sure he's not pirating. And it results in a benefit because I produce more books as a result. Everything except that last benefit is between the two of us. But my producing more books is also a benefit for you who are a customer of a third agency. Indeed, it's even more a benefit for you if you haven't agreed to respect my copyright, because now you can pirate freely. Therefore, the two agencies will underweight that benefit in their bargaining. It's an external benefit, just ordinary externality in economics. And therefore, whatever the optimal level of protection of intellectual property is, my system will give us less than that optimal level. That's clearly right. On the other hand, in my view at least, whether intellectual property is a good idea is very much an open question. I think people have made some pretty good arguments against it. There's a whole book by Baldwin and Levine called Against Intellectual Monopoly. I'm not sure they're right, but they might be right. In any case, for many issues, intellectual property is becoming unenforceable anyway, because for anything that's in digital form, it's very easy to copy it and distribute it. So I think my basic answer is that in a world where you can't enforce very effectively intellectual property rules, people will have to find other ways of getting rewarded for innovation. And some innovation won't happen that happens now, and some will.
Can you give your name?
I don't know all the things that you assert I know. That is, obviously when somebody claims he wants out of an unconscionable contract, it might be because he was fooled, it might be because he wants to cheat the guy who made the contract with him. Both claims will get made. I do not assume that what you observe governments doing necessarily is correct. I reject what people sometimes call the Whig theory of history, that institutions get better and better through time. Sometimes get better, sometimes worse. But to answer your question, if it is true that ordinary people value not being held to such contracts, then part of the product that rights enforcement agencies will offer is the fact that they use a reasonable arbitration agency which says if the special terms in the contract were written in four-point type hidden in the margin of the contract, they're not going to be binding on you. And the market is going to produce that as it produces other things. I guess to begin with, you have the problem for a libertarian as for anybody else of how do you protect children. And there isn't a really good solution because children have neither votes nor money and therefore don't have a very good way of making people act in their interest. And as far as I can see, as a general rule, the people most likely to act in a child's interest are his own parents. That we don't have the option of having a benevolent deity reach down and correct things. I had an interesting exchange some years ago. We had somebody who was a possible hire at my law school. And when he was a law student, he had worked for a law school organization which did voluntary legal work for poor people. And it turned out, it was an interesting discussion, but it turned out that a good deal of his work was poor parents dealing with the welfare and child protective agencies where he was. And so I put a question to him. Do you believe on net that children would be better or worse off if the state had no power at all to control what their parents did to them? And his answer was he did not know for the country as a whole, but in the city where he was acting, they would have been better off. That is, that the cases where the child protective people are taking children away from their parents for bad reasons on net are worse and larger than the cases the other way. There was a particularly horrifying example of this in the U.S. I don't know if you followed it, involving the FLDS, the Fundamentalist LDS group in Texas, where the state child protective people took 300 children from babies up, away from their parents. The excuse for doing so, although they didn't put it that way, was that the children would be raised in the parents' religion, which religion included polygamy and included marrying quite young. You might conceivably have argued that the 5% of those children who were girls ages, 11 to 17, needed somehow to be protected against being pressured into marrying older men. But that does not explain why they wanted to seize boys who were 5 years old. And the answer was because they would be brought up to believe in polygamy, and that was a bad thing. It took about 6 months to get the children back, by which time the appeals court and the Supreme Court of the state of Texas had both voted unanimously that the Child Protective Agency had no right to do this. during which the Child Protective Agency was repeatedly lying about the facts. I could go into details. If you're curious, do a search on my blog, because I got quite interested in this case. That was a particularly horrifying case, but I think even that, you know, adds up to an awful lot to balancing an awful lot of misdeeds by parents. Now, the one thing that I would say is that, in my view, children who run away from home and are capable of sort of sustaining themselves ought not to be forcibly brought back. But whether that would be the actual outcome would depend. The agencies, you know, the parents have a lot more votes than the kids because the parents have more money to bid for what they're getting than the kids. So I don't know if that would actually happen. I have a discussion in Machinery of Freedom where I'm basically arguing for children's rights, but in the form of the right to leave their parents, not in the form of the right to have their parents treat them in a particular way, which I don't think it is practical for external forces to control.
Exactly those. I'm wondering, pre-1946 in the US, and before the establishment of public prosecutor, almost all criminal law was what we would consider state to be civil law, because someone had to approach the grand jury and argue a case and say, can the state please delegate power of attorney to me to actually prosecute the case? And in the UK, I suppose, before police force and the criminal prosecution service, it would have been the same thing. So there wasn't, I mean, even though there was criminal law where you violate statute, there still had to be prosecuted civilly, and so victimless crimes would go unpunished, basically. And I'm wondering,
if you're sufficiently interested, one of the articles on my website is called Making Sense of English Criminal Law in the 18th Century. Because that was a fascinating system where on paper it was our legal system, but the prosecution was entirely private. No grand jury, I don't think, was involved in the process. You had to go to a constable, but the constable was an unpaid official who did not have the job of investigating crimes. And you had to get the constable to arrest the defendant, and then you had to bring in the evidence. And when it was all over, they hanged him, or they transported him, or they enlisted, or they pardoned him, unlike a tort case where you got damages. And so one puzzle is why people prosecuted under those circumstances. But they did. And as far as I can tell, there isn't much evidence that the shift, which started about 1830 in England with the Peel's invention of the police, what basically happened in England, as you may know, is that from about 1830 to about 1870, there were officially the system was the same. There were still no public prosecutors. But de facto, the police were acting as public prosecutors. Prior to 1830, you don't have either police or public prosecutors. So that's a very interesting system. It's less extreme than Iceland, where there's no... And... I'm not sure I can give you a short answer on that. That people at the time were worried that not enough people were being prosecuted. And for a while, they put in large rewards for prosecuting certain crimes. But the trouble with large rewards was that now it paid to frame people or to entrap people in order to collect the rewards. Casanova spent a little while in London during the 18th century. And he mentions seeing in windows a sign. I don't remember if he says what the words were. But he wondered what it meant, and so he asked his English friend what it meant. And he said, oh, what that means is perjured testimony for sale here. So they abolished the rewards as a result in response for that.
Right. Sorry, there's going to be too many to take, but Brian.
Brian, I absolutely adore the Machinery of Freedom when I read it for the first time a long time ago, but I've paid rather less attention to it in recent decades. But you've mentioned it a number of times this evening. On the whole, are you pretty happy with all the opinions you express?
Pretty much. There are certain parts of it that I understand better than I did then. In particular, one of the questions I raised then is what defines a government? Because one response that I've gotten to what I've described is you're not really an anarchist at all. Your rights enforcement agencies are really just governments. And that's an interesting question. And what I said in the Machinery was the definition of a government was an agency of legitimized coercion. And I then went on to explain that I was using both words in special senses. That what I meant by coercion was not what really violated rights, I don't know that, but what people in any society think of as violating rights. And that what I meant by legitimated is not that it was morally legitimate, or even that people believed it was morally legitimate, though they might, but that people did not respond in the way you normally respond to rights violations. So that when the IRS tells you they've frozen your bank account, you don't run down the street yelling, stop thief, or any equivalent of it. And I think that was right. Because it's not trivial to define what a government is, because everything that government does, some non-government agency has done at some point in the past. And I've given you in the course of this talk a little bit of the filling out of that in terms of commitment strategies. Because my answer is that societies function because individuals have a whole bunch of commitment strategies about what they will do in response to people violating their rights. And a government is an organization against which those strategies have been dropped, for whatever reason. And then my claim is you could have a society with no such institution that worked, in which the rights enforcement agencies only have the same rights that everybody else has, basically. So in that sense, I understand better than I did then. I have some additional thoughts on how you might fund national defense that I didn't do then, based on a range of inputs ranging from a Rudyard Kipling story to open source software, with paintball in between.
And actually nothing there which makes you think, oh, how could I have put that?
No. There is the only thing in there which is in a certain sense a mistake, and this was the point of Jim Buchanan's review, is that I didn't think about the question when we're arguing over capital punishment. Does my side have to pay you to get their rule, or does your side have to pay me to get their rule? In other words, what's the default? What's the baseline we're bargaining from? And Jim pointed out that I was missing that. And I've done some thinking about that since, and I've done a little writing on that since. And it turned out that, unfortunately, the answer to that problem slightly weakens a different part of my argument. Because one of the concerns with my system is the risk that rights enforcement agencies will cartelize. That they will say, robbery is more profitable than business, let's reestablish government with us as the government. And how likely that is depends on how large the rights enforcement agencies are. If you have only two of them, it's very likely. If you have 500 of them, it's very unlikely. It's sort of ordinary economics of forming cartels. And in Machinery of Freedom, I assumed that the relevant economies of scale were only economies of scale in enforcing rights. And when I thought through Jim's problem, it occurred to me that there's also an underlying threat game, which has to do with the fact that who pays whom partly depends on how things will go if negotiations break down. And that underlying threat game involves the possibility of using violence against each other. And there might be economies of scale in threats of violence, even if there aren't economies of scale in other things. That at least some military context it is, some it isn't. And that if so, that might undercut my argument. And if I'm right, once the system is well established, it probably doesn't matter, because once it's well established, there's a whole lot of inertia to the equilibrium of mutual threat games, that you don't observe national boundaries moving 3 miles every time you launch a battleship or cut your military budget or whatever. But that in the point when it's developing, it might be a real problem. So that's one of the things that I discuss in the stuff I'm doing for the third edition of Machinery. And that's the closest thing I think that I can remember coming to something I thought was wrong. But it's more filling it out than literally wrong. So yeah, no, on the whole, I'm still reasonably happy with that book.
And when is the new edition coming out?
I don't know. There's this problem with intellectual property law. and also a problem with technological change. The second edition was done by Open Court Publishing. And my contract with them says that if it's out of print for a certain length of time and I tell them about it, I get the copyright back. What does out of print mean? There was a period of like 2 years during which they were doing it as print on demand. And I'm told by somebody who bought one at the time that it was not the same quality as the ordinary one. And if you look at their old web page, they're saying, well, it might take 6 weeks or 2 months to get it. Is that in print? And the best solution will be for them to either agree to give me the copyright or agree to bring out the third edition, which is fine with me. I think the problem is that Open Court isn't functioning very well and therefore is having a hard time deciding to do anything at all. My fallback position is that I will simply write part 5 and web it. And people can download parts 1 through 4, which are already on my webpage. They can download part 5 and put them together and read the whole thing as an e-book of the whole thing. But I would rather be able to actually publish it.
Well, I was at university with Andre Karas, who was the head of the court, so maybe I can put a good word in.
Maybe you can. Maybe you can.
That's the way private law works, isn't it?
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, virtue should be rewarded, so let me thank all of those who asked questions and kept them very brief. except, of course, for Brian Micklethwaite, who did ask two questions very cunningly. I noticed we broke that rule, but enforcement will be administered afterwards. let me thank, in particular, our speaker, David Friedman, who's, I think, raised some very interesting and iconoclastic issues.
Let me also point out what my webpage is, since it's got all sorts of stuff. My webpage is www.daviddfriedman.com. So you need the D, which is my middle initial. If I had applied for the webpage, for the site 4 months earlier, I could have gotten it without the D, but someone else beat me to it.
Well, we're here to discuss important issues of church and state, but we also believe in advertising, so that's great. David D. Friedman. Adam Smith, this little bust of Adam Smith, has been listening very quietly here, but I think he deserves a new home on the other side of the Atlantic. So, David, thank you very much indeed for coming and talking to us. We hope that you will return next time you come through this country and talk to us again. We've had a very stimulating discussion. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me and everyone else for drinks.